Welcome back to Whose Crime Is It Anyway? I'm Lisa.
And I'm Shell.
And we're back with another episode of True Crime from the True North. Before we dive in, we wanted to give a shout out to Jessica and Shauna for buying us some coffees recently on buymeacoffee.com. We really appreciate your support and generosity so much.
Thank you. That's so awesome.
And for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, buymeacoffee.com is a simple way of showing your support for the show without having to create an account. With indie podcasts like ours, all of the research, editing, and marketing is done by ourselves, which we love doing, but it also takes a lot of time. So with your help, we're able to put our funding back into the podcast to advertise and help reach more listeners. So this week's episode originally started as one single case that I was covering, until I kept finding more and more layers that blew this right open. It's a stark reminder of the current epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls in Canada and the United States. With our podcast, we try to spread awareness of these cases because they're extremely underreported and underacknowledged. The families of these missing and murdered women are still fighting for justice and answers.
And they're often not covered in the media very much either. They don't get a whole lot of coverage, and so for us, we're here to shine a light on those stories. A recent inquiry found that Indigenous women and girls are 12 times more likely to be murdered or to go missing than members of any other demographic group in Canada. The amount of cases that have not been taken seriously enough by our own police force is staggering. How many generations of murder must one family endure? Not only are all the women in today's episode Indigenous, they are all related. This is the case of the Osborne family. Take it away, girl.
Claudette Osborne Tayo was born on May 15, 1987. She grew up in Norway House in Manitoba as a member of the Cree Nation. It's a 9-hour drive north of Winnipeg and is the largest Indigenous community in Manitoba. Claudette had a very large family, with Claudette being one of 8 sisters.
That's a big family.
Yeah. Growing up, she was really social. She loved goofing around with her friends and was the kind of friend who would just drop everything if you needed help. When Claudette was 12 years old, her father had to be admitted to the hospital because he had a debilitating breakdown after experiencing a flashback of when he was sexually abused as a child at a residential school. I believe her mom was still taking care of the kids, but it would be at this time that Claudette herself would become subjected to sexual abuse by a family friend. Claudette decided to run away to seek a better life and fled to Winnipeg. There, she met an older man who she began a relationship with. But unfortunately, she found herself again in the hands of an abuser. The abusive boyfriend eventually introduced her to drugs and forced her into sex work. During these years, Claudette had 2 children, Dayton and Layla, and I'm not sure at what age Claudette was at, but at this point, her family intervened and came and got Claudette and helped her check into a drug treatment program.
Ugh, it's just like this story is not uncommon.
I know.
This is, you know, not rare for Indigenous women to fall into this type of lifestyle. And not that they're doing it themselves.
Right.
It's happening to them because of the system that we're in. And
exactly.
It's so tough. And there are so many stories like this. I am glad that her family intervened, though.
I know. Me too.
Did she end up getting clean or did it end up helping?
She did, actually.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So during her recovery, Claudette realized that she wanted to be able to help young girls who were going through the exact same thing that she'd just gone through. So she decided that she wanted to become a social worker.
I love that.
Yeah.
That's so great.
After successfully completing her treatment, Claudette met a kind man named Matthew Bushby. The two of them had a loving relationship and were soon engaged. Matthew welcomed her 2 children, Dayton and Layla, with unconditional love. They then had 2 children of their own together, Isaiah and Patience. but after being drug and alcohol free for 15 months, Claudette relapsed, and in an effort to help pay for her drug addiction, she began working in the sex trade again.
Oh,
I know.
It's hard, and it's
really sad.
It's a cycle, mm-hmm. and it's really hard to break out of it, even with support, mm-hmm. even with a support system.
I know. At around 2 a.m. on July 25th, 2008, Claudette made several desperate phone calls to her family and friends, but they went unanswered. Claudette had been at the Lincoln Motor Hotel on McPhillips Street, where she went to meet a man and said he had tried to force himself on her, so she fled. And this was when she made the phone calls. The reason for meeting this man is unclear, but we do know that Claudette arrived to the hotel at around 11 p.m. So that would mean she was at the hotel for around 3 hours. So if the man was trying to force himself on Claudette, perhaps this wasn't supposed to be a meeting for sex. Maybe this was a man supplying her with drugs and she was getting high and maybe hanging out at the hotel over this 3 hour period. And during that time, maybe this guy had forced himself on her.
I mean, yeah, that would make sense. If we don't know what her reason for being at the hotel is, we can only guess and speculate that this might be why.
Yeah. She said the man was a trucker from Alberta because he had Alberta license plates. The reason she was calling from a payphone was because she had run out of minutes on her cell. And I remember this very well from high school. A lot of my friends, they didn't have a phone plan, so they bought a bunch of minutes. And then once they were up, your phone was useless.
Yeah, it's just like a brick that couldn't do anything.
Yeah. Claudette called her sister, Tina, at 4:30 a.m., and she left a, quote, disturbing voicemail. And this was where the details of what happened with the trucker man came from. But we don't know what else that voicemail said and what those disturbing details were. But 2 hours later at 6:30 a.m., Claudette made one final attempt to call her sister, Tina, but with no luck. And that was the last time anyone has heard from Claudette.
Wow. So we can maybe theorize that this trucker had something to do with her disappearance.
Right.
And do we know who he is? Do we have a name?
Don't have a name, but we will get there.
Okay.
So Claudette normally called at least one family member every single day. And since the family is so big, it took 3 days for them to catch on that Claudette hadn't contacted any of them. What's also really unfortunate is that her sister Tina didn't even know she had a voicemail because she too had run out of minutes on her phone.
Oh my God. It's just like the most unfortunate thing to happen.
I know. So once the family had realized that they hadn't heard from Claudette, she bought more minutes for her phone, and that's when she checked her voicemail, and that's when she heard her sister's panicked voice begging for help. So Tina then reported Claudette as a missing person.
Okay, so this has been a couple of days after her disappearance. Did the police actually act, or did they kind of put it aside like we've heard in other stories?
Yeah. What do you think?
I'm assuming the latter, but I would hope that they would actually, you know, investigate and try to find this woman.
Well, the police told the Osborne family not to worry and that she's a grown adult and will probably show up in a few days. But Claudette's family knew this was so out of character for her, and she would never leave her 4 children and her fiancé Matthew behind.
Yeah, I mean, even if she was involved in sex work and doing drugs, doesn't mean that she's going to just abandon her family or, you know, abandon her life and run off.
Exactly.
So I think this is super valid. Like, her family knows her the best, and they're like, this is super uncharacteristic of her. Mm-hmm. Look into this.
So by the time the police released a missing persons report on Claudette, it had been 2 full weeks. And not only was it delayed, but the photo of Claudette that they chose was from an old mugshot of her.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And to add insult, they said that the last place she was seen was in the area of Selkirk Avenue and Charles Street, which was an area known for sex work.
Also, by putting a mugshot out and giving this information, it just makes the public not even care.
Exactly.
Like, not want to look for her, not connect with her in that way.
Exactly.
It's It's the police like bending the narrative so that they don't have to investigate, so they don't have to do the work.
Pretty much.
And sounds like racism to me.
Yeah. It wouldn't be until 9 months after Claudette's disappearance that the police revised her last known sighting back to the Lincoln Motor Hotel on McPhillips Street. But then, over a year later, they changed it again after they learned that her final call to her sister Tina was from a payphone on the corner of Selkirk Avenue and King Street, about 4 kilometers east from the hotel and only a block away from their original location that they had once set.
Okay, so how did she get from the hotel to this payphone?
Well, we don't know. It would have taken her 45 minutes to get there if she walked from the hotel.
Yeah, that's a pretty long time. I feel like she would have maybe gotten a ride. I don't imagine she took a cab.
Right, there's no like witness coming forward saying that they drove her to this location and dropped her off on a corner.
So maybe within those 3 hours, she walked?
Yeah, we don't know. We don't know exactly what time she left the hotel. All we know is what time those phone calls came in.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's possible.
And were the phone calls all from the same phone booth?
I think so. That's all I could get, was that they had this traced call from the payphone. My assumption is that it's all from the same payphone. And just as a side note, this area that she called from was right along the Red River.
Oh my God, right, the Red River.
The hotel had CCTV footage of Claudette leaving the hotel by herself. But because it took so long for the police to take her disappearance seriously, the footage had already been deleted to make room for new footage.
Of course it did. Yeah. This is why you need to act so much sooner.
Exactly.
Than 3 days or 2 weeks.
Yeah. So much wasted time.
So much wasted time. And of course they're going to tape over the tapes. Like,
yeah. But they would have had her walking out. The man in the truck was tracked down in Calgary. But despite being the last person to have allegedly seen Claudette, he was eliminated as a person of interest. And we don't know why.
Oh, there's no explanation for it?
Nothing.
Huh, okay.
I'm unsure where Claudette's fiancé Matthew was at the time of her disappearance, but he is definitely not a person of interest. But this is all we have. No trace of Claudette has ever been found. Her case has been reassigned to multiple investigators, but according to her family, it's wound up either abandoned or transferred to the next person, which just increases the chances of losing evidence and information.
And this is something we see all the time in these types of cases. Especially when they go cold, they just get passed on from different people and evidence becomes lost. And, you know, any kind of work that they've done to figure anything out, it could be lost.
Exactly. Her sister checks in with the police once a month for updates, but no new information has been released since 2010. Claudette's family hold vigils for her, keeping her story alive and in the public eye. Her mother has never given up hope and has even spent her summers digging up ditches, searching for any trace of her daughter.
Oh, it's just heartbreaking.
I know. Isaiah and Patience are being raised by their father Matthew, and Layla and Dayton are living with their grandparents. But Matthew and all 4 children remain close from what I've seen on his Facebook page, and they celebrate Claudette's birthday and Mother's Day every year. Claudette was 21 years old when she vanished on July 25th, 2008. Despite her past with addiction, she was working hard towards a better future for herself and her children. If she is still alive, she would be 34 years old. When she was last seen, she had long brown hair with blonde tips. She has hazel green eyes, a scar on her right cheek and jawline, and was wearing a black V-neck t-shirt, black pinstripe pants, and a necklace with a silver dolphin pendant. There is a $20,000 reward for any tips or information that lead to Claudette's whereabouts. But Claudette isn't the only member of the Osborne family to be missing or murdered. Claudette's older cousin, Helen Betty Osborne, was murdered back in 1971. This is her story. Helen Betty also grew up in Norway House in Manitoba. When she was little, she was forced into a residential school where her and her friends and family endured unfathomable abuse and suffering. When she was 19, she moved to The Paw, which is about a 5-hour drive east on the border of Saskatchewan, and she joined a blended public school with white people. Her goal was to continue her education and become a teacher and move back to Norway House. Not long after starting at this new school, Helen Betty was found murdered in the woods near Clearwater Lake. Her face had been brutally beaten, and she was stabbed over 50 times. And her case went cold for over 16 years.
Oh my God, I did not think that the story was going in that direction.
Right.
How old was she? She was in school?
She was 19.
And that's so brutal of a murder. It just feels personal, maybe? To stab someone 50 times?
Yeah, like that's angry.
Angry, yeah. And this poor girl already went through so much trauma to then this happened to her.
Mm-hmm. 15 years later, in 1986, a letter was mailed in to the RCMP after they put out an article in the paper asking for the public for information regarding the cold case. The letter was from a young woman, which stated that about a year after Helen Betty's murder, she was at a house party and there was a guy there named Dwayne Johnston that was bragging about killing a girl with a screwdriver. She hadn't come forward because one of his friends at the party threatened her to keep her mouth shut. But when she saw the RCMP's plea in the paper, she put the two and two together and reported the incident. She remained anonymous during the trial. There's been speculation that many people in the town of The Paw knew what had happened but didn't come forward, out of fear of getting involved or worse, because of racism against the Indigenous community. Don't forget, this was a time where residential schools were still running and Indigenous people were segregated from white people at events.
Yeah, it was awful. And I mean, it makes sense why at that time people weren't coming forward, but
right.
Doesn't make it right by
no.
any means.
No. It wouldn't be until 1987 that four men were finally linked to the murder of Helen Betty Osborne. James Houghton, Lee Colgan, Norman Manger, and Dwayne Johnston.
So she was right. It was him.
Yeah.
Did they link them through DNA? Did they save DNA samples?
Well, get this. Lee Corgan was let off because he testified against Dwayne Johnston.
Oh.
Yeah. And then Houghton was acquitted and Norman Manger wasn't even charged because he was allegedly so drunk at the time, he was pretty much passed out the entire time.
Can't they still be charged for accessory, though?
You would think.
Ugh.
When one's wasted and not even coherent, I guess that was his...
Yeah, but how do we know that for sure? That's his right. Testimony.
Well, Colgan was the one who was testifying, so he clearly made that his alibi, which wouldn't even be reliable because they're all involved.
They're all involved, yeah. They all knew it happened and didn't come forward for so many years.
I just don't know why he would choose to only pin it on Dwayne. Why testify only against him?
Maybe collectively the three of them decided, okay, Dwayne's going down for this.
Maybe. So he was the only one sentenced to do time. And according to Lee Colgan's testimony, Houghton was driving and he pulled up to Helen, who was walking along the road in the early morning after everyone had been out at the local bar. Dwayne got out and tried to get her to come with them and party, but she declined. And then that's when they forced her into the car. They assaulted Helen while Houghton drove. They took the car to Houghton's parents' cabin on Clearwater Lake. She was dragged from the car and Dwayne began to beat her while the three other men watched. But because her screams were so loud, they put her back in the car and took her further from the neighbors near a pump station, where she was further beaten and then stabbed. Her clothing was removed and buried a few meters away from her body. As it turns out, Dwayne Johnston was in one of Helen Betty's classes and would openly direct racial slurs towards her, calling her a, quote, dirty savage. And the word savage is something that I wanted to address. Until recently, I never knew the origin and the weight of this word. A friend brought it to my attention that it's a racial slur that's the equivalent to the N-word towards Indigenous people. The word was originally used to describe Indigenous people when they were being colonized in North America. And even though I never used the S word in that context, I still want to personally apologize for ever saying it. I had no idea.
I didn't know this either until you brought it up during one of our last conversations.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good thing to point out. I also didn't know, and I also apologize for using that word too. I mean, there needs to be more education too on how dialogue and narrative and words have impact.
Right.
They affect the people that we're talking about. And so we always want to be as sensitive and as thoughtful mm-hmm. and intentional with what we say on this podcast. So mm-hmm. yeah, thanks for bringing that up. And if we have said it, and I think we have used that word on the podcast before. So going forward, we'll definitely be more mindful.
Exactly. This was a town where everyone knew each other, which makes people a lot more tight-lipped about things, which reminds me of the Tara Grinstead case.
Definitely.
It was later revealed that in the same year of Helen Betty's murder, Colgan admitted to the murder to the sheriff over drinks one night at a bar. But the sheriff, Gerald Wilson, didn't report it until 1986, 15 years later, when the RCMP began asking for the public's help with the cold case.
The sheriff.
The sheriff.
What the actual fuck?
I know.
So this guy confesses to a sheriff, and then the sheriff doesn't do anything about it?
No, nothing. And a woman named Kathy Phillips, who worked at the police station, overheard Colgan talking about the murders in 1978. So this would have been 7 years after the murder. And she also didn't bother reporting it to anyone.
Why? Like, this is not... This makes me so angry because...
It's just a perfect example, though.
But it just makes me feel like that life was worth so little to these people that they didn't even think to report a murder.
Exactly.
It's a sign of how Indigenous women were seen at that time. And I don't really think it's gotten that much better, which is so awful. Like, it's so awful and such a terrible part of our history. And it's just, this would have never been the case if this was a blonde, blue-eyed white woman.
No, we know that. And the tragedy doesn't end there. In 2008, Helen Betty's brother, Kelvin, was murdered at the age of 42 in Winnipeg, where he was beaten and stabbed.
Oh my God, this family.
I know.
So much tragedy.
I know. In 2000, the Helen Betty Osborne Scholarship Fund was created, which provided $50,000 worth of bursaries for Indigenous women who wanted to pursue their dreams, something that Helen Betty never had the chance to do. On August 20th, 2009, just 1 year after Claudette's disappearance, her other cousin, Hillary Wilson, was found murdered in a field near the Perimeter Highway and Highway 59 on the outskirts of Winnipeg. Hillary was 18 years old. And because her case is still open and they need to protect the integrity of the case, the details of Hillary's death have not been released. There's very little information known about her murder, and no new information has been released since. But Hillary has not been forgotten. Her mother remains in contact with the police, checking in to see if anyone has come forward. And after 12 years, her family and friends are still searching for answers, justice, and closure. Like I said at the beginning of this episode, this family has suffered more loss than one could imagine for many lifetimes. The third girl, who is also related to Claudette Osborne, is one who we covered in episode 17. Felicia Solomon Osborne. If you haven't listened to that episode, please do so after this, but here is a brief overview. Felicia was just 16 years old when she went missing while walking home from school in 2003 in Winnipeg. Police took an entire week to show up at her mother's home to take her missing persons report statement.
I remember that.
Yeah.
I remember researching that and being just shocked that even to take a report from her mother.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a young girl.
Mm-hmm.
It's just wild.
And then It took them 2 months after that to finally declare her missing to the public. 1 month after that, partial remains of Felicia were found in the Red River in Winnipeg. 18 years have gone by and her case is still unsolved with no new information. But relating to the other half of episode 17, where we talk about Tina Fontaine, remember the man who was accused of her murder, Raymond Cormier?
Oh yeah, I remember him. He was old. He was in his 50s.
Yeah, who was also acquitted in 2018.
Yes, and they did a Mr. Big sting.
Yeah.
To try and get evidence on him, but he would never break. Like, he never gave them concrete evidence that he did it.
Well, looks like he's up to no good once again.
Oh, shocker. Oh my God, what? I haven't heard this.
So CBC released an article on March 26th, just last month, that Raymond Cormier had been arrested for 4 separate break-ins in January at apartments, parking garages, storage rooms, and mail rooms. They caught him with surveillance footage and DNA from one of the scenes, and he's facing charges for commercial break and enter, residential break and enter, possession of break and enter tools, and possession of property obtained by crime.
Wow, this guy, so is he going to trial? Is he in jail now? What's his situation?
They didn't say. I don't know if he's in jail awaiting trial or if he's out on bail awaiting trial, but he's facing the charges.
Just a terrible guy. Even if he didn't do it, I mean, we can't prove that he did.
Just up to no fucking good.
Up to no good. You're so right. He's not a good guy. And anyone who's in their 50s and trying to lure in a young teenage girl.
A 15-year-old girl.
Yeah. Get fucked. I'm sorry, but no.
Yep.
No thank you.
As you may remember from episode 17 on Tina Fontaine and Felicia Solomon Osborne, we discuss the Drag the Red event, which is where a team of volunteers drag the bottom of the Red River in Manitoba, searching for evidence of remains that could help solve cases of the missing and murdered. Claudette's sister, Bernadette, was the one who created Drag the Red in 2014 after Tina Fontaine's remains were found wrapped in a duvet and weighed down with rocks. The group of dedicated volunteers have even taken courses taught by forensic anthropologists on how to identify human bones. Their goal is to hold the event every year, but because of funding for supplies and the need for reliable boats, they sometimes struggle to make it happen annually. They were actually ready to go for last spring, but because of COVID, it was unfortunately canceled because the volunteers are unable to socially distance on the boats. They haven't been able to do a search on the water in 2 years. However, recently some volunteers have begun searching the riverbanks on foot. And again, because of the pandemic, they're unable to hold any fundraisers to help pay for the necessary equipment. If you would like to donate to the Drag the Red cause, they have an account with the Assiniboine Credit Union and are accepting e-transfers. Our show has already donated, and you basically just go through your mobile app and do a regular e-transfer. You have to set them up as a payee with their email address, and then make sure that you type Drag the Red in the message section at the bottom so that she knows what the donation is for. The email for the e-transfer is bsmith_772@msn.com. And you can also mail a check. So I'll provide all of this information in the show notes. In 2011, the Project Devote Task Force was created, consisting of 6 Winnipeg RCMP officers, 8 Winnipeg police officers, and 6 RCMP civilians. Their main focus is on cold cases regarding missing and murdered women in Manitoba, specifically vulnerable and exploited women, which include Indigenous women and girls. But due to the lack of progress, the task force has garnered quite a bit of criticism from the public. Unfortunately, they've only solved 1 out of 30 cases. In 2019, the Winnipeg Police Service made the decision to step back from the partnership with the RCMP due to recent spikes in violent crime in the area that needed their attention. But they stated that they will continue to pass along information to the RCMP officers and civilians who are still working on Project Devote.
I do think that there needs to be more dedicated action to these cases, though.
I agree.
So, and even cross-functionally, having the RCMP and the Winnipeg Police collaborating together, that's what was
obviously
going on, right?
Yeah, it obviously wasn't working. Wasn't enough.
Yeah, it wasn't enough, but I still think it is better when they're like sharing their own information with each other instead of it being in silo. But I don't think the solve is to disband it and be like, okay, go back to nothing. I think there just needs to be another step that's missing.
Right. And when we see the resources being taken away from these task forces, they lose the family's trust. And as you've learned from all the women I've discussed today, one of the main issues we see with cases involving missing and murdered Indigenous women is the lack of urgency, the lack of transparency, and the dedication towards the victims and their families. Last month, an article was published on the Tyee.ca calling out the RCMP for their lack of honesty on budgets spent on unsolved Indigenous cases. In just over 1 year, the RCMP spent $13 million on policing the GasLink pipeline conflict on the Wet'suwet'en territory. But for some reason, they won't reveal what they spent on investigating missing and murdered Indigenous women. The article says, quote, "Canada's National Police Service can't or won't reveal what it spends investigating cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls." This week marks 1 year since the Tyee asked the RCMP through a Freedom of Information request how much it spent over the previous year investigating unresolved cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. The RCMP have never provided a response.
Wow. They're hiding something. That number is much lower than $13 million, I can guarantee you that.
Oh, yeah.
And honestly, my frustration is that if there was urgency in these cases, if they were taken seriously from the beginning, I believe that these could have been solved.
Of course.
I don't think that these have to be cold cases or that these have to be missing persons. I think that they're out there, and if the resources that, you know, are dedicated to people who are not Indigenous, were dedicated to these Indigenous women who went missing or were murdered, the cases would have been solved much, much quicker.
Right. And the urgency as well. The timing is so critical.
So critical. And when you take 3 days, a week, a month, 2 months, God, it just doesn't even make sense to me.
I know. If you have any information regarding the disappearance of Claudette Osborne, or the murder of Hillary Wilson or Felicia Solomon Osborne, please contact the Project DeVote tip line at 1-888-673-3316 or the Winnipeg Police Service at 204-986-6313. Not only are Indigenous cases more often than not treated with less urgency and importance, we also need to address why these women are more vulnerable. The National Inquiry's final report calls for, quote, "transformative legal and social changes to resolve the crisis that has devastated Indigenous communities across the country." The final report is comprised of the truths of more than 2,380 family members, survivors of violence, experts, and knowledge keepers shared over 2 years of cross-country public hearings and evidence gathering. It delivers 231 individual calls for justice directed at governments, institutions, social service providers, industries, and all Canadians. End quote. Multi-generational trauma gets passed down, and with poverty, insecure housing, limited education and healthcare, and cultural support, they are more likely to find themselves living higher-risk lifestyles, leaving them more vulnerable to violence. Our hearts go out to the members of the Osborne family and Indigenous communities who have endured hundreds of years of loss and suffering. We will continue to spread awareness of these cases and encourage you to all do the same. Claudette Osborne, Hillary Wilson, Felicia Solomon Osborne, and Tina Fontaine are all cold cases. And with that, we are still left wondering, whose crime is it anyway?
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of Whose Crime Is It Anyway? We will be back next week with our last episode of season 3. Then we will be taking a little bit of a break, and we will be back with more episodes in the summer. Until then, follow us on Instagram at Whose Crime Podcast and on Twitter at Whose Crime Pod. And if you would like to support our show, you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/WhoseCrimePod. Bye.
Toodles.